Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Sarah Feinblum. She is the producer-director of the documentary, What Do You Believe Now? The Spiritual Journeys of American Millennials. A little bit about Sarah. First of all, the film that I just mentioned, What Do You Believe Now? The Spiritual Journeys of American Millennials, is a follow-up to her 2002 documentary, What Do You Believe? The Religious and Spiritual Lives of American Teenagers, which came out in 2002. In the 2019 before and after film, a Catholic, pagan, Jew, Muslim, Lakota, and Buddhist offer their deeply personal faith journeys, life challenges, and evolving ideas about higher powers, life purpose, the nature of suffering, religious intolerance, and death. The 2002 documentary aired on PBS stations and screened internationally at venues including the Mill Valley Film Festival and the American Academy of Religion. It was voted one of the 10 best videos for young adults in 2003 by the American Library Association, and is shown at over 2,000 schools and colleges in the U.S. and internationally. Sarah has also created and led workshops nationally and internationally on interfaith dialogue and religious diversity. Her other projects include Earth, Water, Woman in 2013, about Rastafarian women environmentalists in Trinidad, which premiered at the Trinidad and Tobago Film Festival, and her documentary on LGBT activists in Jamaica called Many Loves, One Heart. She has led national workshops on violence prevention for schools, nonprofits, and public health organizations. Her film, Daughters and Sons Preventing Child Trafficking in the Golden Triangle, profiles a program that saves children from sex trafficking and was featured on NPR and won the award for Best Short in Child Advocacy at the Artivist Film Festival and helped raise over $250,000. In Search of the Heart of Chocolate in 2008 premiered at the Palm Springs International Short Film Festival. Sarah has a BA in political science from Columbia University and an MA in education from Tufts. She has taught high school social studies, ESL, and youth filmmaking workshops. So we welcome once again to Common Threads, Sarah Feinblum. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, nice to be here again.
Certainly, yes, indeed it is. So last week we talked quite a bit about the juxtaposition between the first film and the second. But let's recap just for anybody who might not have been with us last week. So in 2002, the documentary, What Do You Believe? The Religious and Spiritual Lives of American Teenagers comes out. And as I just mentioned in the introduction here, you have a Catholic, pagan, Jew, Muslim, Lakota Indian, and a Buddhist, and they talk about their spiritual lives back then. And you were able to, many years later, round the same six people up who are now adults, now people in their 30s, and you ask the same questions or similar questions. You ask how they've changed, and we are able to see how they've changed. And I should mention that I did not see the first one, but I did see the second one, the one we're talking about right now. But that does have some footage of the old interviews. So you do kind of, you do know where the people are starting from and then are able to see the results, at least as of now. Is that's a fair take on this, right?
Yeah.
And so my question is, of the people who are part of the first film, who would you say, if you can pick one, who journeyed further away from where they started than anyone else, if you can pick one?
That's such a good question. Who journeyed the furthest away? Well, I don't know. I kind of want to ask you which one you think. I mean, what was remarkable about all
I would say,
them?
I would say, it was the young Lakota boy who turned in, of course, to a Lakota man. When you see him, how focused he was, as a teenager, how he was so proud of his heritage, how he was working within his cultural and spiritual tradition, really trying to avoid the pitfalls that unfortunately line the lives of so many American Indians, and then find out what happened to him in the ensuing years. It's kind of heartbreaking.
Yeah. That's very true.
And he was the one, last week, you said he was the one who reached out to you. You started looking for the other five people when you decided, I want to see what happened with these kids. And you say he reached out to you. Did he reach out to you before you started trying to find the others, or how did that work?
I had stayed in touch with one or two of them, but four of them I completely lost touch with. And then Julius, his name is Julius Not Afraid, and he lives in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, and he's a world-famous powwow grass dancer. He reached out to me through Facebook, so I really want to thank Facebook, because I don't think we would have found each other otherwise. And he knew that he had gone through some really difficult issues in his life, and he knew that they had impacted him spiritually, and that some of these issues were because he lost connection with his spiritual tradition. And out of that loss came, you know, a lot of problems for him. And so I think he was also quite interested in finding a way to reconnect, and that maybe through being in the film that could help him talk about what had happened to him and why he lost connection with his spirituality, with his Lakota ways, that's how he describes them, and that he wanted to reestablish connection with his culture and his traditions. But, you know, I would say that one of the things that was, for all six of them, each one of them changed in some way. Each one of them, they reinterpreted their tradition. They left it altogether. They blended it with something else. They stopped caring about parts of the things that worried them as teenagers. They maybe had a deeper understanding. It was wonderful to see all six of these now young adults where they'd come to. And I do think they're going to be going somewhere further. So I really hope at some point I'd be able, like in 10 years from now, film them again, because I think they're all very much like all of us. They're in flux, their relationship to their original, you know, family tradition, their family religion is in flux, and it's a dynamic relationship. And then because they have access to so many new, different kinds of information that maybe before the internet age, they might not have been exposed as much to, let's say, meditation or Buddhism or astrology or all these different kinds of things that are available for people to explore now, that this is allowing them to be even more kind of dynamic and reinterpreting and reimagining their beliefs and their traditions. So I think there's sort of a micro trend that is a macro trend in the U.S. and maybe all over the world, where, you know, you meet somebody who's Christian, but they believe in reincarnation and meditation, that they learned as a result of being exposed to some aspects of Buddhism. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One of the people in the film came out as gay.
Mm-hmm.
I can't quite recall. Did they identify as gay in the first film?
No. Not at all.
Talk about that transformation, if you will, and
yeah.
how spirituality played into that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I love about this film is the surprise, right? That part of watching is like you see them when they're a pimply faced teenager, you know, worried about everything, and then you see them when they're 30 and they've become an adult. So I try not to give too much away, but. But this is I'm glad you're picking up on this particular story. One of the teenagers was very much presented as straight and was very much an adherent to his religious traditions and seemed very comfortable about all of it. You know, maybe questioned a little bit some of the rules around sex, like around heterosexual sex, but was very, you know, presented very much as a young heterosexual teenager. But later on, and actually this particular character in the film, he didn't want to be in the follow-up film because he didn't want to come out on camera, but he had since come out to his family that he was gay, and he had left his church because he didn't feel that there was a place for him. So it was a big negotiation with him to make sure that he felt comfortable and safe, and that he could trust me to tell his story in a way that was dignified and wasn't sensationalized, that, you know, that he had, he'd really changed, and because he'd, was always grappling with his sexuality, but once he really had to come out of the closet, then he really had to leave his church because there was no place for him. So that was a really, you know, I think that's probably true for a lot of people in different faith traditions, that they find that there's something about their identity that is so in opposition to the creed or the laws of their religious organization that they're part of, that they sometimes they just have to leave. So that was one case that happened. And he's now looking for some other kind of church that would be more accepting. And we'll see. We'll see if that happens.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Sarah Feinblum. She is the producer, director, and editor of the documentary What Do You Believe Now? The Spiritual Journeys of American Millennials. So, Sarah, be honest with me. You're talking to this young man. He's about 16 years old. Are you saying to yourself, not to him, but is there any inner dialogue going on where you're silently saying, okay, girlfriend, you don't know it right now, but you're gay?
No, you know, I'm pretty good at that. I mean, I've been talking to people and learning about people pretty intensively my whole life. I'm pretty good at kind of figuring out if someone is pulling my leg or misrepresenting, they're hiding something. But, you know, in this particular interview, I did not pick that up. And I think he was just so masterful at hiding it. And I think also, you know, he says he sort of feels maybe a little bit more bisexual. And that was why, yeah, he was able, it just didn't come across, you know. I mean, No, I didn't.
Okay. All right. That's, you don't lose any points on this program for not.
That's good. Yeah. I mean, you know, there are times when I would be interviewing teenagers and adults where I really do have to push them to tell me more, to really be a little bit more authentic. And that happens all the time. And then what you end up seeing in the film is the part where they're being more authentic. But if I, you know, if you push and push and push and someone doesn't want to reveal something, or they haven't revealed it in many ways to themselves.
That's my point. I wouldn't expect him to be trying to pull the wool over your eyes. I would expect him to be in the process of struggling and not wanting to admit it.
Yeah.
That's more often when it happens today, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
well, I think he was so steeped in his religious tradition that he felt that there was no room for him to be his individual self. And so he was really just kind of, I don't want to, brainwashed is really the wrong word to use. I'm trying to find a word. But
inculturated.
Like
inculturated. How's that?
Yes, very, very much. And he also loved his religious tradition. It meant a lot to him, and it gave his life structure and meaning and community. And I think to have to leave it was very painful. So, you know, I hope that one of the things that can happen is that some of these very deep traditions that some of these Catholic churches, Jewish institutions, that they can begin to have a bigger tent and open their arms a little wider to their members. Because when you really talk to people, they can't always fit so neatly into the box, but to lose them is to lose their valuable contribution. So, you know, I think that's in part why a lot of young people are falling away from more organized religions, because they don't, whatever it might be, you know, maybe they're more feminist, or maybe they're more environmentally focused, or maybe they don't find themselves represented in a way. And so I hope that we can kind of think about that as a society, so that everybody can be included. You know, that's kind of the underlining thing. It's like, from the films that I've made is to say, hey, we are all here. We're all human beings. Can we see ourselves in the other? Can we embrace the other? Can we value the other one's perspective? It might not be what we believe, but can we see that it's valuable and worthy of respect and protection, and not find it threatening, you know? So whether it's done inside your religious institution or it's just done between us, you know, can we get there? And I think it's really imperative that we do, because we are a multi spiritual and religious society. We're very, very diverse, and that I think makes us rich and strong. And you know, it's just like biodiversity. It's human diversity that I think is of great value, and we can learn from each other. So there's my little preaching part.
Well, thank you. I'm interested in your educational background. I can kind of see the poli-sci inside you. You have your bachelor's in poli-sci from Columbia, and you have your master's in education from Tufts. I don't see any film cred.
Never went to film school.
tell us how that happened, how you ended up being a filmmaker.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a good question. You know, I used to be, when I was teaching in the public schools in Boston, the Rodney King riots happened out in L.A., and the whole country was kind of up in, you know, just felt like the whole country was kind of up in flames, that there was just a lot of
my students were really noticing the violence and the racism, and I decided I was going to make a film with my students about violence and nonviolence. And I think that sort of is a kind of a precursor. It's sort of a religious question, you know, where does violence have a role or not, and what is sacred, and how do we solve these complex problems? So I ended up making a, really not knowing what I was doing, but for many reasons, kind of out of my students' questions and confusion, decided that I would make a film with young people about violence in their lives and communities. And when I made that film, I made a lot of mistakes. I made it with a friend at the time who did know about filmmaking. But I got hooked on filmmaking, and I got hooked on this idea that if you gave young people a voice, they could educate each other, and they would really listen to each other, and they wanted to hear from each other. So I included my students as filmmakers, and they made profiles about their lives and the role of violence in their lives and communities. And that kind of set me on the path to make the next film from the perspective of teenagers about their religious and spiritual lives. And that's why I made that film. And then that's why in the film that you see now, I mean, there's no narrator. It's just really very much creating a vehicle, a framework for people to speak for themselves very personally about their experiences. So that's how I got involved in documentary filmmaking.
No, that's quite fascinating. Yeah. And certainly so many people who are at the height of their craft, particularly in the area of the creative, were not academically trained exactly in that area. They usually do have some academic training, a degree in something, but not necessarily in exactly what they're doing at the time.
Right.
So that's
cool.
Yeah, of course, absolutely. I mentioned last week, and it bears repeating this week as well, that the documentary that we've been talking about, What Do You Believe Now? The Spiritual Journeys of American Millennials, at this moment, as we are speaking, is not available in the West Michigan area. However, this conversation is available as a podcast, and so there may be people listening all over the country, and it's possible that there might be a showing near them. And if there is it on your website? Are all of the showings listed on your website at this point?
I don't think so. I think we need to update that.
Well, this is
a good inspiration to do it.
Yep.
Yeah, and if there isn't, you can contact us and we can make plans with you to have a screening. That's really our goal. And the six now adults in the film can also come and be part of a screening and a Q&A. And they're really marvelous human beings, and they have a lot to say. I was able to bring Julius Not Afraid with me to a high school screening in San Rafael. And it was just, when do San Rafael teenagers in Northern California really get to meet somebody who's grown up on the Pine Ridge Reservation and has connections to all of his spiritual practices? I mean, Julius is a sun dancer. He knows all about the Sweat Lodge. He knows all about the Peyote Church. He's just a really extraordinary man with a lot of knowledge. So I'm really hoping to be able to bring him to talk, as well as all the other ones who are in the film, to bring them with me and speak, because I think there's just so much more to learn about all of them, and they're really special people. I'm just so proud of all of them and who they've become.
I will mention that having seen the film myself, that you really did a good job. You say you culled them out of a couple of hundred other kids way back when, in when you were making the first film. And whatever intuition you were using, I think, was working in overdrive, because they seem to present themselves well in the clips from the old film that are included in the new film. And as adults, they do a wonderful job of presenting for themselves. So, yeah, good on you for for making good choices. And I will also mention that people who are interested in a screening or learning what you're doing right now can go to gooddocs.net, and that's good, and then docs is D-O-C-S, again, .net, and people can find you there, right?
Yes, they can.
Wonderful.
And we really want to screen this film. I think right now in America, it has particular relevance. I mean, the first film I finished right before 9/11, and actually the Muslim family in the film decided to leave the United States for a while because they felt so unsafe. And it's interesting now that I finished this next film, and we're really seeing a rise in anti-Semitism, anti-Semitic attacks. We're seeing other kinds of religiously motivated hate crimes. And so I feel like this is, again, my offering. Here's a tool that people can use to get to know each other, to stop fearing each other, to understand each other. And that's why it's so beautiful right now in the United States. There's so many groups. And there weren't back in, you know, the 1990s the way there are now. There's so many interfaith groups that are really doing this hard work of bringing people together.
And that's
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. That's what we're certainly trying to do with the Interfaith Dialogue Association and Kauffman Interfaith Institute. But I have to stop you there because we are down to the wire again, Sarah. But I want to thank you so much for your time today and last week as well. And seriously, best of luck with your film.
What an incredible honor to be on your show. Thank you so, so much. I'm really grateful. Thank you.
You're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and Sarah Feinblum has been our guest. She is the producer, director, editor of What Do You Believe Now? The Spiritual Journeys of American Millennials. Please join us again next week here on WGVU.